Thanks so much for tuning in to 91.9 WDRT, listener supported radio. You are listening to The Skeptical Naturopath with Paul Rettet and Christina DeRocher. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Christina, how are you?
I'm doing great. We're doing a part two
We're just
of.
continuing the conversation because we couldn't fit it in an hour.
That's right, part
Surprise,
two of
surprise.
hormones.
Yeah, hormones. So where do we leave off? Well, let's talk about things. So I, remember hormones are communication. Maybe something that I didn't talk about is think of a hormone and how they actually function in the body, right? So this is kind of this lock and key metaphor. So hormones are like the key that fit in the lock, and understand that so that hormone binds to a receptor. So the receptor is the lock. The hormone is the key. It fits in there and it, opens the door or does whatever, or it activates something in the cell. And that may be on the cell membrane. It may be in the cell nucleus, right? We've talked about thyroid being the thermostat of the body, but that's working kind of inside the cell, not on the cell. So, all these different parts of the cell will have receptors for these hormones. So that, in other words, that what's going to be affected by estrogen or thyroid or cortisol is where we find cortisol receptors or we find estrogen receptors, right? And in some cases, right? So, example, just even breast cancer, right? Some breast cancer is estrogen positive, some is not. Means it's not being mediated by estrogen and it won't really have an effect on that, which means we don't see the estrogen receptors on those cells, right? 'Cause so. Anyways, so that's kind of how the body does it. So the different cells will have different receptors, being that, well, maybe it has a cortisol receptor, maybe it has an estrogen receptor, right? And we can see that it may bind cortisol in one aspect and then insulin in another, and it does different things, right? And this is kind of this hormone balance that we talk about. And there's not really interplay between the different hormones, but within the hormone itself, there may be, competition for that receptor site, right? So I've talked about T4 and T3. They both have similar binding properties, the receptors that they bind to, right? And, estrogen, we talk about estrogen, and estrogen has, there's the phytoestrogens, right? Like soy or flaxseed. So that's those act like an estrogen, like estrogen. So they look like the estrogen key, right? But when it gets into the keyhole, it doesn't quite open the door as much. It's kind of a more modified effect or an attenuated effect. And part of the effect of the phytoestrogen may be, okay, the soy has a weak estrogenic effect, but it may keep strong estrogen from binding to it, right? So that becomes a competition. So the more things that you have circulating in the bloodstream or that are there, they're going to compete, and then it may end up attenuating the estrogen response because the phytoestrogen has a weaker response in the cell.
Yeah,
So it may have a
sounds.
protective effect. Even though it's a weak estrogen, its effect may be because it's keeping a strong estrogen from binding to that. Right. So just this is just another layer of confusion, right? Another layer of biochemistry of what's going on. And this is where, that we have that conversation on soy, like, is soy a good guy or a bad guy? Right? Because you're like, is it worth having a weak estrogenic effect? And for the most part, I'm going to say, I don't know that soy is a bad guy. I mean, I'm going to look at soy and how is it processed and that kind of thing that I look at, not so much because it's a phytoestrogen, it's a bad guy. I'd be like, you've turned it into a seed oil and I don't like it, but that has nothing to do with phytoestrogen content, right? It's just a reason that we would label a food as good or bad, like what makes it good or bad? And then, different things for different foods. It may be good in one way and bad in another. Anyways, so
So
that's a.
and so how do we know? How do we know that we're not damaging ourselves by ingesting food that isn't proper for our particular hormonal balance?
Oh gosh, I don't know. How do we test that, right? How do we know? And is it just, do we just avoid these? How do we know that there's competition going on? How do we know that this is having effect? I mean, we can do some tests where we look at like urine samples and we say we can look at different estrogen metabolites. And from those metabolites, we may make some assumptions to say, oh, wow, you're not quite breaking it down properly, or you're breaking down a form that's recycled versus this form, like there's two estrogens and four estrogen. They're just 2-hydroxy, 4-hydroxy, 16-hydroxy. So there's different metabolites that aren't estrogen. But by looking at those, we may get a sense like, oh, wow, you're not really metabolizing that properly. Versus like we'd like to see more of the quote-unquote good estrogen versus the bad estrogen. So bad estrogen is being recycled back in the body. Good estrogen is on its way out. I mean, I'm being a little simplistic here. But understand, in somebody that's got osteoporosis, that may be the opposite effect. Maybe they want more estrogen that's being recycled instead of estrogen that's on its way out. So remember, context is king here.
Yeah, N of 1.
Yeah, and N of 1, like what's your determination? So, but again, we look at a test and say, oh, that's bad or that's good. And, you know, it's, again, maybe useful, but I don't know that it's diagnostic. That's what happens in functional medicine land, right? We have a lot of tests that we can do, and we can sort of, I think we can end up over-interpreting them. Mm-hmm. Right, I have a patient right now, a 12-year-old with, you know, ADHD, and, you know, I've tested him for heavy metals, and his heavy metals are, like, through the roof. It's, like, the worst, maybe the worst heavy metal profile that I've seen, and it's a 12-year-old. I'm like, oh, my gosh, you're toxic. So now we're doing things to treat that, but he's really not better, and if I push too hard, I actually make him worse. And I'm kind of like, oh, wow, okay, am I forgetting something here? And how much do I just focus on the metals because that's what I see, right, because I have a test on that, versus saying, hey, maybe there's some other things to consider here, right? I mean, it's just the reality of working with people, because you do something, I'm like, oh, you're metal toxic. We're going to clean up those metals and everything will be better, but that hasn't happened. But I know if I push them hard that I make them worse, which makes me say, okay, I'm doing something, but maybe I'm not clearing enough, right? Or can we do other things at the same time? This is practice, right? This is the art of medicine, right, that I, you know, we've got to really try to look at all these variables instead of just say, well, am I just looking at this because I have the blinders on because I did a test? That's why I worry about the test, because then I start treating the test and I don't treat the patient.
Now, do you feel that way about a continuous glucose monitor?
Not so much.
Which is another test.
Because a continuous glucose monitor isn't really diagnosing anything for me, right? So, for example, a CGM, continuous glucose monitor, is going to just give you feedback on what's going on with your glucose levels. So it's not really saying I'm diabetic or I have these things. I mean, you can maybe make some interpretations from that, but understand that a CGM isn't, like we've talked about, isn't even measuring the blood. It's measuring the interstitial fluid, right? Okay. That's where that sensor lies. And again, that's fine. It's just that maybe I can't translate to what I see on a continuous glucose monitor what I'd see from a blood draw from the lab, because they're testing my blood, whereas the CGM is testing my interstitial fluid. And I think they're definitely correlated, right? I don't think that there's a huge difference, but it still may be different. So in other words, then looking at values may not be the goal in that. You're looking at patterns. And that's why I like the CGM, right? Because we're looking not just what one level of glucose is, right? Like I talked about last time, is that if somebody's free falling on the glucose, right, they're really hangry and their blood glucose is 98, and you're like, well, that's normal, you're not hypoglycemic, well, why are you hangry? Because they were 110 5 minutes ago, right? They're free falling, and now the body's, you know, going into reaction mode to try to regulate that.
And that's what the CGM tells you, is not just where you are, but where you've been.
Yeah, where you've been, because it keeps monitoring it, right? It's every 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. You can't escape that unless your monitor turns off or something, right? I mean, you're sleeping. You're getting data while you sleep. And then people will spike when they sleep. And then it's like, whoa, is this a problem or not? I don't know. Is it based on what you did before you went to bed at night? And what's the pattern there? And I may look at that and say, well, that may just be an anomaly. Maybe you had a bad dream or something happened that triggered that blood glucose. But if you didn't wake up and you were starving and you went to the fridge to eat, I'd be like, well, you didn't react to it. But, you know, is that controllable? That may just be, that's an issue with CGM, because it may be stress. It may be other things that are going on that influence that, right? Remember, we've talked about cortisol. Cortisol increases your blood glucose. So you're under high stress, you may spike your glucose, and that has nothing to do with the carbohydrates you ate. And then are you tracking your stress response, right? Because then you're like, oh, wow, maybe that's it. And then you try to, you know, in my world, it's all about reproduction. replication. Like if we see a bad pattern, we say, okay, here's what I'm doing, and it doesn't look so good. Okay, well, let's tweak that a little bit and say, do we see that same pattern? Or let's do the same thing and see if we continue to see that pattern, right? That's why I like a CGM, because it allows you to experiment and give you immediate feedback. Whereas if I do a heavy metal test, that's one moment in time. And not that that's not important, but it's still just saying, here's potential body burden here. And and is it a perfect test? It's not a perfect test, but it's an approximation for me to say, wow, this is a really bad test. We need to do something about it. But again, like I said, when I don't see as much clinical, if I don't see what I expect to see, then I'm like, I'm still missing something.
Yeah. So for instance, with a heavy metal patient, would you put him on a CGM? Would that be helpful?
Well, he's 12 years old. So, and they've already done the experiment when they went keto for 2 weeks. Or really low carbohydrate, right? So I've already done that. Well, I mean, full story is that I see his brother, right? And I've really helped his brother, and I haven't helped him as much, right? So the point is that we're just doing this and we're doing that, and then his brother may respond differently. And I'm like, wow, you know, I kind of say, well, what works for one should work for the other, but that's not necessarily the case.
N of one.
Right, and N of one. And even though they're genetically related, it's still a different response to that. So I've sort of done all these things. Like heavy metals wasn't the first thing I've tested. So, I mean, full disclosure is I've been doing other things without tests on that. It's just I'm like, we got to look because things aren't working. And then I'm like scratching my head. I'm like, well, are you metal toxic? And then I do the test. I'm like, oh my gosh, you're metal toxic. Like really bad. But again, the response to that isn't like, oh my God, everything's better. So, you know. That's practice, right? Things don't always work like you they should, but anyways, that's my point on, you know, doing testing. And CGM is, I mean, it's a test, but it's like more like constant feedback. Right? Yeah, it's like a feedback tool. It gives you that information to say, hey, here's how I responded, and here's how I responded over time. It's not just a one moment issue. Right.
And so going back to hormones then, where were we with,
we were talking about insulin and cortisol and how that's a disaster, right? So let's just repeat that. So high insulin and high cortisol, that's a really good way to gain weight, right? Because again, understand, and part of that can be from the aspect that you're on this blood sugar roller coaster, that your glucose goes sky high, you secrete a lot of insulin, then you come crashing down and you secrete a lot of cortisol. This is really a bad pattern. Like, we don't want that pattern. And again, cortisol could be coming because you have high stress and not related at all to your blood sugar, and that's also going to be an issue, right? But again, nutritional stress is relatively straightforward to deal with. Emotional stress, much more difficult. Anyways, so that's kind of where we left off on that, right? So that's, again, the hormones, like, working in a synergy, perhaps, if you want to talk about that. But that's kind of how that works on that. And that's why somebody could be on a ketogenic diet and have high blood glucose. I mean, I don't know that I see that frequently, but they could be having high stress response and their glucose could be elevated even though they're not eating any carbohydrate.
Interesting. Okay.
Does that make sense? And generally, it's not really going to elevate, but it may stay kind of on the high end, where you think like, oh, we go down to 70 because I'm on a ketogenic diet. But remember, you still make glucose even when you don't eat carbohydrates. And what do you make glucose from when it's not from a carbohydrate? My favorite pathway. Okay, the liver does it. You're right on that. But what's that? Do you remember the name of the pathway? Because now I'm going to talk about that. This is a good transition.
No.
So it's the liver. So the liver is turning something into carbohydrate. What is it turning into carbohydrate? And the answer is not... Nope, not fat.
Carbs.
Nope. Carbs are carbohydrates. So you're now making a carbohydrate from a non-carbohydrate. What's the non-carbohydrate that you're using? I'm a teacher, right? Again, there's this idea that if I say something 10 times, they'll know that. And I know that's not true. But I know that I've said this a few times because I like saying this. So.
Oh, man.
So, okay, so it's not made from fat, and it's not from carbohydrate, because carbohydrate is, you know, basically glucose. So what are you making glucose from? There's only one thing left.
Protein?
Yes. So your body will take protein and turn it into glucose. That's why somebody on a ketogenic diet does not go to a blood sugar of 20. And the pathway that's called is gluconeogenesis.
Oh, right.
Does that ring a bell?
It sounds familiar, yes.
Yeah, I love that, right? That's my favorite pathway. Gluconeogenesis, so making new glucose. So making glucose from a non-carbohydrate, so that's protein. But understand that when you do that, that's a lot of work. It's a lot of energy. You got to take protein and you got to change the protein molecule. You got to remove. So protein has nitrogen in it. Carbohydrates and fats do not have nitrogen.
Right, because they are blood.
Well, they're blood, right? But they're basically they're energy sources, right? They're used for energy. Protein is a building block, and the only way it can be a building block is it needs a nitrogenous base on it. It needs to have nitrogen for that to happen. So nitrogen is what gives us life, right? I mean, it's what enables us to build things. Carbohydrates and fats don't really build anything. It's not totally true, right? I mean, you build glycogen from carbohydrates and you build cell membranes from fats. So I'm kind of...
Is it almost like carbohydrates maintain in a way? I mean, they kind of give you a bump a little bit.
What do you mean maintain? Maintain energy?
Instead of... Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's what I think of as carbs. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, so it's quick. So carbohydrates are like kindling. Fat is like a log. And
that's what I meant.
Protein.
Yes, exactly. And kindling will maintain the flame, right?
Right. It'll burn quick, but it's not going to burn long. And again, you can get other carbohydrates and look at the glycemic response and the glycemic load and say, well, maybe it's a little bit more like a stick rather than kindling. Or maybe you know, what would burn quicker than kindling? I don't know. It's like a spectrum on that. Yeah, so again, so it's kindling versus logs versus, you know, think of protein. I think of protein as plastic Legos. So why plastic? Why not Lincoln Logs? Okay, so plastic, what happens when you burn plastic? You get that nasty smoke, right? It stinks. It's like toxic.
Yeah.
So that's how I want to think about protein. Again, not that it's toxic, but that you kind of have, you know, it's kind of dirty when you burn it for energy. It's not a clean burn.
Because it gives it has to be detoxified at some point. Right.
So it's the nitrogen. So what happens is your body has a protein and it removes the nitrogen. This happens in the liver. And then once you remove the nitrogen, then you can turn that into a carbohydrate or a fat.
Okay.
So some proteins are used to make fat, some are used to make carbohydrates, some can be used to make both. In fact, most of the amino acids can go either way. You can use them to make carbohydrate, you can use them to make fat. But understand that that's not a motivating factor for your body, right? So first of all, you get this, you know, dirty residue, which is nitrogen, which your body has to get rid of, right? Nitrogen is like ammonia. Ammonia is totally toxic. You dilute it down or change it into something and eliminate that. So again, that's why I use the plastic metaphor there, right? Because it's kind of toxic or burdensome or what have you. Anyways, and that happens in the liver mostly. It does happen in the kidney if you're on, like, you haven't been eating for days and days and days. Your kidney will kick in and start to help with that too. But anyway, so that's gluconeogenesis. So in other words, if your blood sugar is low, your liver can get activated and make some blood glucose. That's what it does. That's gluconeogenesis, right? You start making glucose from protein, right? And again, so then the idea is, you know, what mediates that? So now you're taking protein, but you're getting the liver to release glucose. On the flip side, your liver can also store glucose, right? So the liver is this big mediator, right? It's super, super, super important that it plays a role in our metabolism. And in glucose metabolism, it has the ability to suck up extra glucose, and it has ability to dump glucose into the bloodstream. And I've talked about this, where the liver is a selfless organ, whereas the muscles are a selfish organ. Have you heard me say that before? I can't remember if I've said that.
Sounds vaguely familiar.
Maybe,
yes.
Okay, 2 years ago. So selfish means that it uses the energy that it has all by itself. So, for example, we store glycogen in our liver. We store glycogen in our muscles. And that's why, basically, why athletes train. They want to build their glycogen levels because that gives them that, like, extra energy. Glycogen is human starch, right? It's instant. It's quick energy that's available. And so we build that up, right? We put it into our muscle cells. The thing is that the muscle cell is going to use all of its glycogen itself. It's not going to give it away to anybody. It's selfish. Whereas the liver will do that too, but the liver now is giving it away to anybody. So it basically dumps it in the bloodstream. So it's playing a role in systemic regulation. That makes it a selfless organ. And more important, right? Because that's what the body's going to, the blood, you know, the blood's going to detect that, or, you know, you're monitoring, well, monitoring your blood. I'm not sure that's the right piece. But regardless, so the bloodstream is where, you know, this is happening. So that's the liver, you know, dumping or increasing the glucose. And it can increase the glucose by breaking down glycogen or by turning protein into glucose.
And I want to say thank you so much for tuning in to listener-supported WDRT 91.9 on your dial. You're listening to The Skeptical Naturopath with Paul Rattay and Christina DeRocher.
Yeah, thank you.
I didn't forget.
Thank you
this
for your
time.
Timing.
Yeah. Okay,
I forgot. So that's one aspect, right? And so then, you know, what hormones kind of regulate that, right? So we see things that play a role in playing a role in increasing your glucose, right? Because now your glucose is low and you're starting to trigger those things, right? And we talked about cortisol doing that. Cortisol, I mean, it's not really going to mediate the liver so much in this way. It doesn't affect the liver as much as it does other cells. Well, then that's not true. It does affect the liver because it's turning on gluconeogenesis. So cortisol can mediate that. That's also where glucagon plays a part, right? So glucagon, you remember I talked about insulin. And I said there was glucagon. So glucagon's sort of, I mean, it may be kind of a boring hormone because we don't talk about it much, and it kind of works behind the scenes. But super important that when your blood glucose is falling, that the glucagon kicks in to help your body start increasing the blood glucose, right? So that's one of those hormones that work along with cortisol, right? Cortisol meaning kind of more of the stress response to try to respond to that. So I would say that cortisol is the if you're free falling, that cortisol may be more dominant versus if you're just kind of coming down, right? You're on the kiddie roller coaster and you went up and you're coming down, but you don't come down really abruptly. It's very gentle. That then glucagon mm-hmm. will kick in and do that, right? You may not need cortisol more for its sort of acute isn't the right word, but, you know, more aggressive effect on that, right? So those are hormones that will play a role in increasing your blood glucose. And then on the flip side, then we have insulin. So insulin does the opposite. Insulin is now saying, hey, we want you to burn carbohydrates, and it'll actually get the liver to store extra carbohydrates. Because if you have too much, your blood glucose level is high, that's high motivation for your body to say, hey, we got to do something about this.
Right,
because that's toxic.
It
will kill you. Elevated blood glucose will kill you. So we manage that. And insulin is one major way to manage that, right? So insulin, basically, like we've talked about, it gets all the cells in the body to suck up the glucose and use glucose, including the liver. But the liver really, I mean, it can use it for kind of its own energy. But really, the liver is taking that glucose and turning it into glycogen, right? That it can store there until you need it on a rainy day. And glycogen is a rainy day thing that you will use. Fat is a little bit more different maybe a little bit more difficult. I don't know if difficult is the right word, but, you know, not as readily accessible. Glycogen is quick energy. You need quick energy, you break that down really quickly. It's just that glycogen takes up a lot of space. So you can't store that much of it. Fat, you can store a lot of fat because it packs together real well. So it's an efficient way to store a lot of calories. the question is, why do we get to the point that we have to store all this fat? Because you've been over consuming, or, you know, whatever, but, you know, you're using more than you need. And then it ends up in your fat cells.
You're ingesting more than you need? What do you mean you're using more than you need?
Yeah, you have more energy than your body's actually using. I mean, this is the classic how you treat weight, you know, what's weight loss? You need to eat less and exercise more. And that's not necessarily wrong. It's just that I think that you could change the way that you eat and you may exercise more because of what you're eating. And changing the way that you eat rather than just saying, I'm going to count calories. I mean, counting calories works, but I'm not sure that leads to long-term compliance, and it's not necessarily getting you more of as a what I would say an active participant, right? Active participant means when I eat this way, I'm not hungry, versus when I eat this way, I'm starving.
Right. Yes.
We're looking for hunger and energy as the things that we want to improve, which we really can't test. Anyway, so we've got the insulin here that's playing a role on that to say, okay, use glucose. It's getting your liver to store glycogen, but glycogen eventually hits its limit. Like, you can't make any more because the liver has limited storage. Like, its glycogen stores are full. So what does the liver do with extra carbohydrates, extra glucose, that when they can't make any more glycogen because their stores are full? What do they do then? What does the liver do?
I mean, isn't that where you get fatty liver? I mean, it's still
correct.
Puts it somewhere, right?
So it's converting the glucose. So now it's like the glycogen is full, and now it's converting the extra glucose into fat.
Yeah, and storing it.
And it could be in the liver, and then if it's in the liver, that's non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, right? Or fatty liver disease can store in your fat cells. I mean, you name it, right? But this is part of the mediation on this. And this is the liver playing a role. So it's kind of like, and again, that's the simplistic approach to say, oh, well, just lower your insulin, you're going to lose all this weight. Yeah, maybe, but that's only part of the story, right? That's part of it. I'm not denying that, but I think there's a lot more going on than just insulin levels being high. That being said, I mean, I always test insulin. I'm looking at that. I'm trying to see if somebody's hyperinsulinemic. But again, like we've talked about, the goal is not so much to be on a ketogenic diet the rest of your life, but try to figure out what your carbohydrate tolerance is, right? How can you manage the carbohydrates that you're eating? Or how are you managing the carbohydrates that you eat? And can you change things? Can you eat less carbohydrate? Can you change the timing of them? Can you add other foods to them, right? Can you eat them in the evening versus the morning? I don't know, right? These are the things that you can experiment with. And that's why, again, I go back to the CGM, right? Because the CGM is going to give you the data on that, right? And it's wearable technology, and people love that stuff, right? It's just that, you know, it's in your
even
arm.
At the gym. Honestly, I go to Orange Theory now, and
you
have
see
a
people with the
heart,
CGMs,
a heart monitor.
Oh yeah, but do you see people with CGMs? Like, I see it now, right? I'm at the gym and I look, and I'm like, oh, you got a CGM in. I went to a play at the Guthrie, and one of the actors had a CGM. Gabriel and I were sitting really close. So we're up close. Like, we could see the actors that were spitting. We could see the saliva flying on which actors had more saliva flying than others. I mean, it's great. But one of the actors had a continuous glucose monitor on.
Wow.
Because I know it, right? I see it. I mean, I'm very cognizant of that. And like, that's a topic of conversation. If I see somebody with a CGM, I'm like, oh, you're wearing a CGM. Like, for diabetes, you know, whatever. But that's... Maybe that's not the way to open a conversation with people, but me putting
not.
My foot
but
in
you
my
would,
mouth, right? Yeah, well, I would, right? Yeah, or maybe not love me or whatever. But why are you wearing a CGM? It's none of your business. Oh, okay. All right. So, anyway, so that's these hormone. That's like the hormone symphony, right? That we want the balance between these, and again. That liver is just such an important organ to kind of help as a buffer both ways. It can release glucose into the bloodstream. It can also take it up and turn it into fat or turn it into glycogen. And it'll change, right? You can go on a moment's notice and all of a sudden you shift from being more catabolic to being anabolic. Right? So anyway, so that's an example of sort of these hormones working together, right? Or kind of the synergy effect, which is a little different than when I talk about insulin and cortisol or cortisol and thyroid, right, where they're actually interfering with things. In this case, it's sort of more of a synergistic effect to help regulate blood glucose, which is really super important. Okay, so that's one aspect. And then we have this other concept that I like to talk about called feedback inhibition. And I'll use the...
Say it again?
Feedback inhibition.
Okay.
So this is... I'll use the adrenals as an example here. But I could use a reproductive hormones or I could use thyroid. They're very similar kind of response here. So this is the idea. If you remember last time we talked about... thyroid, right, that your thyroid produces inactive hormone, and most of what it produces is inactive hormone. And we're like, why does that happen? So that the cells have the ability to control that rather than the thyroid. Anyways, so feedback inhibition means that we have this like long drawn out system that we have multiple places that we can control the production of the hormones. So the adrenal glands work on what's called the HPA axis, right? H is hypothalamus, P is pituitary, A is adrenal. So the HPA axis. And what happens is it's a whole cascade of events. So when you see the bear in the woods, right? And again, your body responds immediately to this. So this whole process happens very quickly. Well, I'm talking about cortisol. So, yeah, actually, anyway, so the brain will sense that and you go into flight or fight. So the release of cortisol, let's look at that. So cortisol, remember, is the adaptation hormone. So it's how you're adapting to stress. It's not quite waking you up, but it's helping you to continue to have the stress response. So what happens is the hypothalamus in your brain senses like, oh, there's a problem here. We need to secrete. We need to activate cortisol. But it doesn't release cortisol, right? It actually releases cortisol releasing factor, or cortisol releasing, or corticotrophin releasing factor, CRF, or sometimes they call it CRH, corticotrophin releasing hormone. So that's a hormone secreted by hypothalamus. But that's not really working systemically in the body. All that does is it signals the pituitary gland, which isn't very far away anatomically. It signals to the anterior pituitary, and the anterior pituitary responds to the CRF, and it releases ACTH. Right? So ACTH is adrenal corticotrophic hormone. Right, now we're getting into all this naming thing. This is the problem with biochemistry. Yeah. There's too many names of enzymes and molecules, and then you get totally confused. And they're really long. And it's not like, oh, that's protein C3. Right, maybe that would be easier. Anyways, so that CRF, all it does is trigger the anterior pituitary to produce ACTH. Then ACTH is released, and then that is picked up by the adrenal cortex. Right, and then the adrenal cortex gets that signal and it says, oh, I got to release cortisol, and it does. Right, so in other words, this is a three-step process. There's three different hormones or two different hormones to get you to release cortisol. Again, you'd say, why the heck has that happened? This seems like it's all long drawn out. But actually, well, again, this is cortisol, not adrenaline. So yeah, it is kind of long and drawn out with cortisol. But why would the body do that? Why doesn't it just secrete cortisol? What do you think? I'll give you a hint. It's the same answer that was for the other one. It's the same answer to why the thyroid produces inactive hormone.
Because it wants to be able to handle itself.
Yeah, you want to be able to regulate it. You want to regulate this. And this leads to what we call feedback inhibition. So feedback inhibition means that this whole cascade is activated and then cortisol is released, and cortisol will be sensed by the hypothalamus. So it goes back up into the base of the brain and it's picked up by the hypothalamus and it's like, oh, there's cortisol here. And then the hypothalamus says, I mean, it's not saying, but it responds and says, okay, we're good. I don't need to secrete any more cortisol because I got cortisol. Because I'm getting a signal that there's cortisol there, so I'll turn off.
Yeah.
But then you're like, oh, there's still a bear. But then there's a signal that says, oh, no, we're fine. We've got it. And then this is, you know, this constant sort of battle that goes on. And then over time, you can develop cortisol resistance. And you're going to see I'm going to talk about insulin resistance in a minute, which is perhaps a bigger deal. But cortisol resistance is this idea that you're secreting cortisol from your adrenals, but it's not inhibiting the hypothalamus response. Do you understand? So now you've got resistance to cortisol, and your body is keeping to pump out cortisol, whereas we want that to shut up. It's like the boy that cried wolf, right? So that happens, and then you don't listen to it any longer.
It's played out.
It's played out, exactly. So this is this is kind of a key thing, because then this is going to lead to problems down the road, right? Where we start seeing, because the adrenal glands are very adaptive, right? I mean, you beat up your adrenal glands, they keep working. I mean, even if you're really under high stress and lots of fatigue issues, your adrenals are still working. They're just not working ideally. Right. So that's just the sense of trying to, engage that system.
And keep it regulated. What it's supposed to be doing. Regularly.
Right. And then you get good signaling, and then you get it to turn off and you get it to turn on, instead of like overwhelming it constantly. And eventually it can begin to break down, right? And the breakdown, again, it's really hard for me to test this. I can't test it. I can test your circulating levels of cortisol, your salivary cortisol, and that may give me, here's what your pattern's doing, but it's not giving me like, oh, I know there's cortisol resistance. Like, how do I test that? I suppose there's ways that they do that, which I don't know. But maybe there's some in-depth kind of thing that you're looking at cellular dynamics and determine that. But for the most part, if we just measure your salivary levels, it's just telling me that's what's in your salivary. It's not telling me whether your brain is listening to it. Like, I may have to I may have to consider your symptoms to say, oh, wow, you got a problem here. And that's why, again, that's the doing the test of that. Then I treat the test and I don't treat the person. Right? Yeah. We do an adrenal profile and it looks fine. I'm like, you don't have a problem. Yeah, but they do have a problem because they're telling me all about the problem. I'm like, but your labs look fine. Your test looks fine. Well, discount the test, and maybe there's resistance going on. Maybe there's something that we can't test that's happening. Again, I got to treat the patient instead of treating the test. The test can be useful, but in my world, usually it's not first line.
N of one. I mean, really.
Always N of one.
Even with results, you have to look at what's actually in front of you.
Yeah, correct. And not forget the patient. And, it's a trial and error thing. And, that's how I practice. It's how, many, I would say, naturopaths, functional medicine people practice. It's just that I'm not sure that I got to do, $2,000 worth of tests. And I'm going to tell you this, and here's what you have to do. See ya. I'm like, you need to be more of an active participant here. But that's my approach. I'm trying to encourage you to be an active participant instead of somebody that just, here, I'm going to take supplements. Because taking supplements is easy. And I'm not saying they don't, and it's not helpful. But are you addressing the cause? I'm not sure. I mean, if you're vitamin D deficient, that'll make a big difference, right? So, it's that classic, what's the answer? Well, it depends, right? My students love it when I say that.
It's kind of maddening, and yet there's a certain freedom in it.
Correct.
Because you're really looking at a specific situation.
Yeah, and again, we oversimplify, but that's what we do as humans, right? We have this narrative. I mean, I call it the narrative fallacy. Is that we always put it in kind of a story, like we need it in a story mode. And that's not bad. It helps us understand it better. But we're trying to simplify complex biochemistry. I mean, I don't have all the answers. I just know some of the different pathways. And I know enough to know that, oh, my gosh, I know nothing.
Right.
And then you're just kind of like, okay, well, I'm not sure, but let's try this and let's see if that works, right? That's pretty much been the story of my naturopathic life. Try something, let's see if it sticks or if it works, and then we'll go on from there.
Right, right. I mean, it's amazing what we do know compared to what we didn't know even 50 years ago. I mean, really.
Right, correct. But we know more, but is that making the treatment better? So it's like the microbiome, right? I can do a stool test and tape your microbiome. And I mean, I did the stool test 20 years ago. I get very few markers on it. Now I get all these markers. But I'm like, what do I do with that? I'm almost like inundated with information. Like, it's not overly useful. Like, I see you low in Prevotella, and I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to give you Prevotella. Well, I don't have Prevotella. There's not commercially available, but that's what you're low in. That's what I need to give you. That may not be the right thing. Maybe we haven't cultivated a healthy microbiome for the Prevotella to exist there. Do you understand? I mean, this is just, getting a lot of information and then being kind of paralyzed by it or not knowing what to do. And again, you know, that's just my approach is generally like I know where to start when I hear somebody's story. It's when the story's, you know, when I hear the story and what I'm doing is not working, then I'm saying I'm missing something we need to test.
I'm going to jump in and say thanks for tuning in to 91.9 WDRT, listener-supported radio in Viroqua, Wisconsin. Skeptical Naturopath with Paul Rattay and Christina DeVersher.
Yay. All right, so that's this resistance thing, right? And so that's an example of cortisol resistance. I think we see thyroid resistance. I don't know if that is so much estrogen resistance. But now that we get to the biggie, right? The biggie is insulin resistance. So the biggie meaning that I'm going to call that the hidden epidemic, right? Okay. The hidden epidemic that we see a lot. And I'm gonna kind of combine some things together, right? So I would say that that's insulin resistance. We'd also see metabolic syndrome or something that we call cardiometabolic syndrome, which is kind of an offshoot of that. Like insulin resistance is part of that. And then also non-alcoholic fatty liver disease would be another sort of manifestation of that, right? And NAFLD.
Are you saying that these four are related?
Yeah, I'm saying they're all related. And how they're related is because there's insulin resistance.
Okay.
So insulin resistance is at the core of the onion on this case, right? Whereas cardiometabolic syndrome and NAFLD, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, would be kind of outliers, right? It's just another way that we characterize and we say that, but underlying that more than likely is insulin resistance. And so we treat the insulin resistance, or that's how I approach that, right? So for example, NAFLD, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, I mean, the numbers are like 18 to 24% of Americans have it. Meaning that if we look at a liver ultrasound, there's a 24% chance, right, 1 out of 4, that you have fatty liver disease. 1 out of 4? That's pretty high. I'm going to call that an epidemic. I don't know. That's my take on that.
Right.
And we really need to address it. But we don't go looking for it. But MDs aren't out there like looking for non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Oftentimes they find it by mistake, right? Or they find it because they did an ultrasound and it was a, you know, ultrasound of the liver, and they're like, whoa, wait a minute, you have fatty liver. And then the patient's like, oh, what do I do about it? Well, you know, eat better and lose weight. And okay, well, that may be helpful, but you can't offer me like more direct kind of things to do for this. Anyways, that's a lot of people that have that. It's a significant issue. Significant. Okay, so what's underlying this? So insulin resistance. So we talked about cortisol resistance, right? That's the brain not responding to that. Insulin resistance is the same sort of thing, but happening, you know, maybe on more on a cellular level. Right, so insulin resistance means that now you're eating a carbohydrate and you secrete insulin because you're trying to manage those carbohydrates, but now the insulin starts to lose its effectiveness. So the insulin isn't working as well. Your cells are becoming resistant to insulin. And what do you think the body does when you become insulin resistant and you got blood glucose that's elevated, which is a problem? What's your body going to do?
It has to lower it at all costs.
Yeah, it's going to lower glucose at all costs. So how is it going to do that? So the insulin's not working very well. So what does the body do if the insulin's not working well?
It has to create it itself?
Yeah, sort of. It just secretes more insulin. The insulin's not working, then the body's like, more insulin, more insulin, more insulin. Right. Remember, we kind of talked about this last time, too, that what starts to happen is that you secrete more insulin in order to get your blood glucose under control. But if I test your blood glucose... go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, just otherwise you die, right?
Correct. So your body is going to, you know, tightly regulate that glucose. and it is potentially over-secreting insulin, but understand that I do a test of your glucose and you look totally normal. But I'm going to say, because, wow, we got a problem. But I look at the blood glucose and it's not a problem.
It's not a problem because the body had to work overtime to create it. But what you see is the result,
exactly,
not how hard it had to work to get there.
Exactly. So we want to get some sense as how hard is the body working to manage that blood glucose. And that's what an insulin is going to tell me, a fasting insulin. And that's what I don't measure on a continuous glucose monitor.
Right.
So that's in my dream world, in my imagination, I have a fasting continuous insulin monitor. So insulin would be more valuable than glucose because I'd know how much and how hard you're working to manage it.
Right.
So in other words,
we can only know so much with the CGM.
Yeah, correct. We don't know what's going on behind the scenes. But, you know, you could test it. So I generally will do a fasting insulin as a test as part of my profile. And that gives me insight, but it's still not telling me insulin every 5 minutes. I'm just saying, what's your fasting insulin to try to get a sense of it? Are we dealing with some hyperinsulinemia here? And, I have a very tight level in how I read that, right? The reference range on the lab is huge. I'm like, nah, it's too wide. But anyways, again, so I'm trying to look and say, what are you doing to keep your blood glucose managed? Because you may get your normal blood sugar. You're like, I don't have a problem. I don't have to do anything about this. My glucose is normal. It's ideal. Yeah, but are you working hard to do that? That's what I want to get from the insulin, right? Or that's what the insulin will give me some insight on and say, whoa, way too hard. We got to take some of that stress off. So that's what I call pre-diabetes. Right, so there's diabetes, there's pre-diabetes, so diabetes is fasting glucose over 125, along those lines, right? A1C over 7.2, you know, the range somewhere in that. That's what we're going to use as the diagnostic criteria on that, right? Definition of diabetes. So what's pre-diabetes? Pre-diabetes is blood sugar between 100 and 125, fasting glucose. So at least MDs are reflecting on the fact that, hey, maybe we need to deal with prediabetes. And yes, that's important. I'm happy. I'm happy that we identify that. What does an MD do for prediabetes? Do you know?
What is the what?
What's the medication for prediabetes?
No, I don't know.
It's metformin. And metformin's really super cheap, and it helps, right? I mean, it's working to lower your, you know, to help manage the glucose. But that's like knee-jerk reaction. If somebody's insulin resistant, or I'm sorry, pre-diabetic, we give them that.
Band-aid.
Yeah, Band-aid, metformin. Metformin causes a lot of GI upset and other things too. So people have issues with that. But I'm just saying, at least they identify pre-diabetes and they have something to do about it.
Right.
Right. At least when they see non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, they're like, you could lose weight, exercise more, change your diet. Okay, could you be any more specific?
Yeah, right.
So that's pre-diabetes. And then what I call pre-diabetes means that your blood glucose is normal. But
what?
Yeah. Pre-diabetes, your blood glucose is normal. So what's going on there? I'm not going to tell you because now you're all shocked. Now we have to burn this synapse in now.
It's normal, but
why
you're
would
still
I call somebody with a normal diet, my normal blood glucose? How could I say they have pre-diabetes?
I know, I'm offended.
Well, I could see kind of hypoglycemia, right? I could see this up and down, and that may show that I may not see that like on an A1C. The A1C may look normal, but what else? What else would I look at to determine that? What would tell me that you have pre-diabetes? Meaning that your normal blood sugar is a kind of a facade. We just talked about it.
Oh, man. Your blood glucose, right?
Nah, like if it's your blood glucose is normal. You've got a normal blood glucose. You've got a blood glucose of 92, fasting blood glucose of 92.
But I say you
have pre-diabetes. Why would I say
but
that?
But that's the... Because that's the only the effect. It's not how hard your body's working to get to that point.
So how do I know how hard the body's working? What am I looking at?
The liver. You're going to look at the liver.
Yeah, but I be a little bit more specific. or a lot more specific. But be more specific.
The fat around the liver?
Nope.
Your metabolism? So your ability to...
Nope, I'll give you a hint. I'll give you a hint. It's a hormone.
Oh, man. I don't know if that's a hint.
Well, we've only talked about, what, six hormones?
I know.
Three, four, five, six, seven.
So cortisol?
Not cortisol. You're going to really feel stupid when I tell you.
Thyroid.
What's the other one with cortisol?
Insulin.
It's insulin. Remember, I talked about testing fasting insulin.
Oh,
and they have a really high fasting insulin. So having a high fasting insulin means that you're overworked. Your body's secreting a lot of insulin to get that blood glucose normal.
You're right.
And your blood glucose is normal. So we're like, there's not a problem. Yeah, there is a problem because your insulin's high. So it's kind of incomplete. And do I do fasting?
It was too obvious.
Yeah, I know.
It was too obvious.
Yeah, I know.
Dang it.
I mean, that's how I try to teach, right? That I'm repetitious. I repeat myself over and over.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that always works. But, you know, again, the idea is like try to get you to think about it in like three different ways that maybe I burn that synapse then. I don't know. Anyways, so insulin resistance, like I said, there's a spectrum. It's a spectrum disorder. Right? It's not just your fasting glucose is over 100. That's part of it, right? But you could have normal glucose and still have insulin resistance. So that's sort of what's underlying things. So symptoms of insulin resistance, right? So things that I would see that would kind of tip me off for this would be things like constant hunger, inability to lose weight, sugar cravings, migrating aches and pains, fatigue, upper abdominal obesity, or, you know, the apple body shape. And how often do you think I see those symptoms?
Lots. Those sound like very common symptoms.
But then the whole issue is if you have fatigue, then I'm going to say to you, oh, you have insulin resistance. I don't know that, right? Fatigue could be like 10 other things. So you got to be careful, right, that you can't just say all fatigue is this.
Quite a few very specific things.
Yeah,
like
right.
Eating a lot of sugar, constantly hungry, unable to gain or unable to lose weight. Those three right there seem like a pretty common trifecta where you could look at your situation. I mean, for instance, I don't eat breakfast anymore. I used to. Actually, I can't even remember when I did because I didn't even when I was a Waldorf teacher. But I eat around 10 o'clock. And it's usually a snack, honestly, because I'm cleaning houses. So I'm busy. It has to be handheld. Ants on a log are my favorite, actually.
Yep.
My favorite snack. And then I come home at around 1 and I have a light lunch. And then I have a dinner, but it has to be at least 3 hours before I go to bed because I'm neurotic like that. So it's usually around 6:30 and I'm in bed by 9:30, even if I'm reading, you know. Yeah, for instance, I know then, as you list those off, that I'm not pre-diabetic even because I can go without sweets and I'm not driven by hunger throughout the day.
Yeah, but is this still possible? You may be have elevated fasting insulin? Maybe, but, you know, maybe that's still just a gauge, right? And again, it's this kind of a spectrum thing too, right? And again, I don't have a continuous insulin monitor is what I would really like. Because then that's telling me how you're responding to that. But I don't have that, right? Or they don't have that.
Yeah, because I would be really curious because it doesn't sound like I have any symptoms, but I also lived on sugar before I was macrobiotic, like in my teen years. I don't know. So, interesting.
Right. We don't know. We take the information we have and we try to go with it. But again, routinely, I test fasting insulin when I do lab work. Because I'm just curious, and somebody comes back with an elevated fasting insulin, I'll be like, ooh, this is an issue. And even if, as I said, I'm just treating the test, I mean, a fasting insulin's not lying to me. And I'd be like, we have a problem, but the problem is, is a carbohydrate tolerance problem, not like I got to give you a bunch of stuff for this. Like, you're eating too many carbohydrates, maybe the wrong kind, we got to figure out how to, like, rein that in. Which is, on some level treating the cause. But anyway, so those are symptoms of insulin resistance. And understand, insulin resistance is also this idea of cardiometabolic syndrome and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. But understand that that insulin resistance, then we can start to see other hormonal balance issues along with that. Right, so I've kind of alluded to this, like with estrogen dominance and polycystic ovarian syndrome, right? So that insulin plus estrogen is a bad combination too. So there's all these things that happen. We also see high cholesterol and high triglycerides. So I'm really super sensitive to triglycerides on a lab test. So the common reference range is under 150, but my reference range is under 80. So already that means you come in and I do a lipid panel, triglycerides are on there, and I see at 120 and I'm like, we got a problem. But the patient's like, hey, it's within reference range. I'm like, yeah, but it's above 80. It means you're on the road to that. You're on the road to insulin resistance. You're on the road to hyperinsulinemia. Right? So I get that sense and I say, okay, well, we can do something about it right now. And again, I can look at triglycerides as well over time, right? So somebody will have a lipid panel, and I'll go back 5 years looking at their lipid panel, and their triglycerides were 70 5 years ago, and then 4 years ago it was 86, and then 3 years ago it was 98, and then 102, and then now it's 120, and I see it's been this gradual increase, all within the normal range, but very bothersome to me. Right, bothersome means that we got to do something about this. And that's basically liver function stuff. That's blood glucose, that kind of thing. The fasting triglycerides give me a marker of what is the liver doing when there's no fat, when there's no food around. And if your triglycerides are high, it means it's working really hard to turn glucose into fat.
Yeah.
That's bad.
There's your overworking. Well,
it's not bad. It's too much,
again.
Right? We're pushing too hard.
Well, this is the end of the road here for this episode. Do you feel like you worked out all of the things you wanted to say about hormones?
Oh, I could say more, but that's pretty good.
Know,
we
right?
got through my little one sheet. Maybe the one sheet was a two sheet, two episode
I
sheet.
I think it
right?
was. Yes, yeah, it yeah. was two sheets for sure.
Anyway, so this just understand that insulin resistance, cardiometabolic syndrome, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is an underlying epidemic, and many people have that and they don't know it. And again, what's the solution? I don't have a drug for it. I don't know that I have a supplement for it. I mean, there's supplements that help. But the whole idea is it's a lifestyle thing, right? We've got to start looking at, we've got to take responsibility for what we think, how we move, what we eat. Because that, at the end of the day, is
what's important. The things we have control over.
Yeah, the things we have control over. So that's the end of my story. Yeah, you're welcome.
Always a pleasure.
Always. Thank you, Christina.
Until next time.